accession number 301-3085, Real 2.
So I took out some of the airline stuff my father had given me, which had little free soaps in them.
End of Reel 1, Nicholas Gibbs. Reel 2, Nicholas Gibbs. Yes, so they would have been in the throes of a war, would they not?
They were in the middle of the Croatian War, because you had had the Slovenian War, which I think six people were killed, and that was it, and Slovenia got its independence. Croatian War, Vukovar had finished, but the UN and the Yugoslav army were still in Zagreb. The UN had taken over the one of the tank barracks of the Slav army, which was situated next door to the hospital, because it's a sort of eastern way of looking at things, is that you put a barracks next door to a hospital because you know that it's not going to be bombed. So there were trams, there were UN everywhere, there were soldiers everywhere. The Croatian army was ragtag. I remember seeing troops wearing gym shoes and mixture of uniforms, and they were heavily demoralised and defeated. And the first time I was there, I didn't actually paint. It was a look and see. I wanted to see how much. I made a few sketches, and I had no idea of how I was going to get into the war zone. And in the hotel there were a whole lot of Canadian UN troops, so I tried to naively say, come on, take me in. And they kept on saying, have you got insurance? I said no. They said, well, no way are we going to even touch you. But the hotel was full of refugee children running riot. There were blackouts all the time. It was full of truck drivers doing the relief columns. Breakfast was sort of help yourself, real Eastern European stuff. It was hot at the time, I remember, and so I just walked around the town looking, and it reminded me of childhood in Germany, because of the trams, because in this country we don't see trams at all, and here are these blue trams, which I gather all over Europe now. There were troops all over the place, which I remember when I was a child in New Zealand. NATO troops. There were Canadians who used to walk around New Zealand, and I think even Americans, because the PX wasn't far from where we lived. I seem to remember visiting the PX when we lived in Germany, and obviously the NAFI and the British side. And eventually, I ran out of cash. And when you have 2 million, you don't really actually make a note of how much money is getting out of your pocket. And although I could pay anything in the hotel with credit card, nothing outside. And then to my absolute horror, when I went to the station to get out, because I was going to stay for 5 weeks, and I was only been there for 3 weeks, and I'd run out of cash, and I still had my ticket out an airline, and therefore I had another 2 weeks to go. So I thought, right, I'll get a train up. So I went to the station, and they wouldn't take a credit card. They would only take cash if it was foreign travel. So I had enough cash to get me to Milan. That was the furthest I could go. So I thought, right, I'll get to Milan, and then I'll use my credit card for the rest of Europe. So I bought my ticket, but I still had a couple more days. And the awful thing, I remember the hotel receptionist asking me what nationality I was. And when I said I was English, she said, could I help her get a job in England because of the war? My last day I was there, I was walking on the upper part of the town. Because the town, Zagreb, is made of two towns on two hills. And they fought each other. And the legend is that they fought each other to a standstill, and eventually they decided to join together, and so therefore it became Zagreb. Zagreb was also hit by an earthquake, I gather, which was bizarre in that area. Anyway, on the last day I was walking, and there was a whacking great explosion, and I, so used to IRA bombs in London, went down on my haunches thinking, where? And nobody batted an eyelid. And I looked around and looked very foolish. And I wandered round. The day after I got the train out, and when I got to Milan, and I switched on Sky News, it came on that a rocket had landed in Zagreb, and that's what I'd heard. But nobody had batted an eyelid, which I found absolutely extraordinary. But anyway, we'll go back to when I caught the train. We were kept waiting at the border for 4 hours going into Slovenia, and that's where I got that picture there, which was a bomb at the border. There was a bombed out train, and that was extraordinary because we were in the sidings. We were directed into the sidings, and I was thinking, what's going on here? And it was one of those sort of stations where you have to step right down onto a very, very low platform, which is almost only a pavement. And on the other side was this cargo train, which had obviously been shelled. And as you see with that carriage got a direct hit, and it hasn't exploded, it's gone straight in. And that's a petrol tanker. And then behind was a train that was totally burnt out. All the cargo wagons was totally burnt out.
So would you have taken a photograph of that?
I didn't. That was a photograph, yes.
Yes, I was wondering what their attitude was, you know, to cameras.
I wasn't sure, so what I took with me was an expensive cheapie, a plastic thing that was guaranteed to take good photographs. So it wouldn't matter that much if it was confiscated or it had been broken. It cost me £35. The only drawback is that it had a built-in flash, which was not good if you were taking surreptitious photographs. So I had to watch that one. But I took several photographs there, but not very much of the war, because I couldn't get into the zone. But the train journey back was extraordinary because it took 14 hours to get from Zagreb to Milan. And we went through Slovenia, and it was wonderfully forested. It was sort of idyllic, it was Arcadia, with waterfalls and forests. And I remember the people in the carriage speaking this very strange language. I was trying to work out what it was, because a lot of the words ended A and O, like Italian, but they're using lots of Slavic words too. Mm-hmm. And the Slovenian language, which is a mixture between the two. And we crossed into Italy, and suddenly the whole countryside changed to scrubland, and you heard the crickets. And we came around the top of the Adriatic, looking down, and you had these wonderful Italian villas, almost out of the film, like the film Death in Venice, with these huge long pencil trees, the citrus trees, and the sea was azure blue. And we went through Venice Maestro. We went through all the classical Italian towns, Verona, Padua. God knows where we were going. We got into Milan at, where was it? I think it was Venice Maestro. Everybody got out. And then a whole lot of Italians got in. And there was a gypsy who got in. And he smiled, he had no teeth. And I then hid all my credit cards in my shoes, which was terribly uncomfortable. And we got into Milan at 2 o'clock in the morning, and I went straight to a hotel, because it was one of the sub-railway stations of Milan, Lombardo or something, but it was on the edge of Milan. Got a hotel, woke up the guy, he came down very sleepily, gave me a room, I switched on Sky Television, that's when I heard the thing. But what was fascinating, when I switched on television, there was the end of an American film, but it was on Sky, and it was Alan Ladd. When I was a child, when we first went to Italy, and we went over the Alps, we went to stay in a pensione just in the foothills of the Alps inside Italy. And in the bar, we as children were allowed to watch a film, American film, but it had been dubbed into Italian, and we were told to go to bed, and so we never saw the end of the film, but I always remembered where we left off. To my amazement, I switched on the television, and this film appeared on television at the place where we had left off. Goose pimples down the spine. Anyway, next day, I had very little cash. I had enough, because they would take my credit card in the hotel, So I decided to go and get some cash through a credit card. Classical thing, go all to the Italian banks, and they look at the credit card and say, no, and hand it back to you. Even though they had MasterCard on the window. So after the fifth time, I lost my temper, and I said, you have to, because you've got it on the window, you must. And I said, I'm not leaving here until I get money. And he went away and he said, we give you money. And so I got enough money to buy my ticket from then on. And that was an extraordinary journey as well, because I thought it's a night journey, and I certainly wasn't going to sit upright in a seat all the way to Calais. So I got my canvas, my spare canvas came in a great sheet out of my suitcase, and I rolled myself up in my canvas and I slept on the aisle of the floor like a shroud, dead body. Which is very strange, because the train going over the Alps banks, and when you're lying on the floor you can feel the banking, and you're swaying from side to side. Anyway, I was turfed out at Metz, changed trains to Calais, ferry over, then train journey from Dover, or was it Folkestone? I can't remember which one we landed at. London, and then Glasgow. And that took 3 days altogether. So that was my first time in Zagreb. So I rang a friend up, and they said, oh, you should have told us. We have contacts out there. So 3 months later, I was back there.
So you'd obviously seen enough the first visit to know that you could do a job there.
To do a job there, and yes. I knew I could survive out there. Mm.
But how, you were talking about this explosion in Zagreb, how damaged was that city at that
very
time?
Undamaged, very undamaged. I was told much later that I had seen more war than most of the population in Zagreb.
So it was relatively cut off from the war, that?
Yes, there were... The Serb nationalistic headquarters, somebody bombed it straight away, someone had thrown a couple of grenades to the window, and it was still a ruin in the middle of Zagreb. And I remember the sort of net curtains sort of flying around in the wind. And that was the only thing. But there were 20,000, when I went back there, I was told there were 20,000 Serbs living quite happily in Zagreb. So nobody was that bothered. But that was my first example of, I suppose, a war situation. Well, it wasn't that much different from London, actually, because you had the IRA bombing, and there were more bombs in London than there were in Zagreb. And I do remember in New York, because I also, at the time, was visiting New York. I was living in New York, in fact, at the time, because, although I took a flight out from England, I had been in New York 3 weeks before, and I had a girlfriend in New York. And I decided to live in America as well. So I'd gone, only spending 3 weeks in New York, back to England, then back then out to Zagreb. My intention was to go back and live in the States. So I came back to England, stayed with some cousins, then went back to where all my furniture was, and then flew back out to New York. We lived, then we went down to Philadelphia, and then I flew back to England to go up to Zagreb again 3 months later.
This time going to Zagreb, did you have, were there differences in what you took? You know, having been done your recce, really. That's your first trip was a recce, wasn't
well,
it?
Well, we have to also, as you talk, suddenly things are coming back, because it was 12 years ago. I remember going to lots of English people who had been doing relief columns, and there was one girl who I was introduced to called Harriet Sands, who had done relief columns to various places, and she said, take a sleeping bag, take this, take that. So I went and bought from Army Surplus all these things. In fact, I needed none of them, because I operated in a completely different way to what the relief columns operated, and I lived the life of the local population, not separate. And I was totally integrated.
So how did you manage that? You know, getting back there, did you fly again?
Well, how did I get back the next time? I was trying to think how I got back. How did I do the next time?
From the UK,
I think
it would
be. I did by train.
Did you? By train? Wow.
How did I get back there? I didn't fly in, I don't think.
Oh.
Well, I know I changed flight. I think the first time I changed flights at Zurich. No, I didn't fly. I think I took a train.
But you do.
That's right. I took a train, and I was met at the station. Or was I met at the station? I can't remember, in fact. But I took a train. That's right. I took a train. And I had a heavy suitcase, and by this time, I had a friend who was at a language school in Oxford, and she told me they had reciprocals with the Zagreb language school, and I was put in touch with the principal of the Zagreb language school, and she talked to me on the telephone and found me a place to stay, which was a little old lady. Oh, she wasn't so old, although she looked old. She was only in her 60s, didn't speak a word of English, and it was two streets away from the UN headquarters. And it's off Ilica, which was the main street that ran through Zagreb. And it I remember going the first time you went off the street into a sort of little area of trees and grass. And those typically European front doors, which glass panels either side, and it was that the metal grids embedded in the glass. But at the same time, all the glass had tape all over them for explosions to keep the glass from flying around. You got these very sparse and dark stairwell, and then all the flats are off it. And one of the teachers of the language school lived in the flat below. That's how I got. And with the lady that I stayed with, we communicated through sign language and little drawings. And she was frightfully, almost over-helpful. She wanted to be helpful all the time. And I remember she would knock at the door. I was given a little room that had a sofa in it, which became a bed. And one of those, they have in lots of Zagreb, all the communist flats, a heating system, which I suppose in days gone by would have been wood-burning stoves, but this had been converted to electricity, and that was in the room, although it was never on, and a window that opened up into a sort of veranda. And she would knock at the door and she'd say, come, and she'd have soup for me. But I was not used to European soup, which looked like to me a bit of grease with looked like a sponge, which was some sort of pasta floating in it. And I would sort of eat it. But she was very nice. And then the woman downstairs, Jasna, who spoke English fluently, did all my translation when she was back. And Jasna was very, very helpful. And first of all, supplied me the cigarettes. Second, was supplied me, telling me what to do and what not to do, where I should go, what I should. And often, Jasna would take me out in the evenings to various places, tell me which trains to catch, which buses to catch to the battlefronts. And then I talk about it afterwards, what I'd seen. And I go to parties, they go to dinner parties. I was totally then involved in their circle of friends. And to my surprise, they all spoke English, which was great. And so once ensconced in this flat, I would take the train straight to the battlefronts.
Where were the battlefronts at this time? This would now be 94, wouldn't
it? This was the time of Gorazda in Bosnia. Gorazda was going on at the time, and I was in I was almost a trophy to the Croats, because I said that my father had known Michael Rose, because Mike Rose had been in the Coldstream, and my father was Mike Rose's company commander. And Mike Rose had wanted to leave the army because he said he didn't want to, because he was a double first. He was one of the first officers to have a double first. And my father sat him down and convinced him to stay in the army, which is... And then he was what, a second lieutenant or a captain? I think a second lieutenant. So I told the story, and therefore, in the estimation of the Croats, I could do no wrong. So
So they obviously admired him.
Yes, I think they did.
Yes.
The news every... I remember seeing the Croat news every night, and the little old lady would call me and say, come, come, look, see, Serbi, Serbi. And there were pretty horrific news footage of Serb dead, of Serbs who had infiltrated or been killed on television. So I saw a lot of that. Taking trains to the battlefront, you just take a train, and they were wonderful old trains that sort of rattled along the lines. Countryside was fascinating as well, because they didn't farm as we do in Western Europe. Everything was done rather sort of in a feudal system, where they had strips of land, and they would plant a strip probably about 10 yards wide of maize, probably by about 200 yards, 300 yards long. And there were hundreds of these strips all the way along the railway line. Countryside was beautiful, unspot, but it would be because there'd been no industrialisation. The communists had destroyed various areas, but had left other areas totally untouched. I can't answer for the rivers, they probably have polluted those on the stop. I think if you'd gone into the river, you would have come out a skeleton. But I remember going over the river in Zagreb, and it had been diverted, because I gathered it had flooded all the time, so they'd actually diverted canal-like away from the city, which again was quite sad, because they'd ignored tradition, ignored nature. This was the great communist building, we defeat nature. But going back to the train journeys, I would go to Karlovac and Sisak.
Karlovac and...
Sisak.
How do you spell that?
S-I-S-A-K.
And these are both, of course, in Croatia, aren't
They're
they?
In Croatia.
Yes. So what was happening in these places?
Almost nothing at the time. They had skeleton populations, but they still had shops open, which was bizarre, and yet here there were these sort of European shops selling everything, and who was there to buy it? And I do remember the first train journey I took, it stopped at a station, and everybody started running. And I thought, what is happening? I thought, it's like incoming shells. Well, there was no noise, but everybody got out. And they were getting out with their baskets. They had ducks, they had chickens in their baskets, live ones that they'd taken to market, because they all came to Zagreb to sell in the fabulous market in the centre of the city. We call it a town, in fact, because it was a town, really. And so I then got out rather apprehensive. And I suddenly discovered why they were running. Because that was the end of the line as far as the train went, because the line had been taken out further up. So there was a bus, and they were all running for seats in the bus. And it was the most bizarre bus, because it was a tourist bus, and it had all mod cons in the bus. It had videos which obviously didn't work. And all this gabbling population were running for the best seats. But suddenly this was the era of war, because there were bombed out buildings all over the place, rubble all over the road. So that was my first real sight of the battle zone, and I knew I was there. And as we went in and got into, I think this is Karlovac, the building, it started off with every 10th building being taken out, and then every 5th building, and then every other building, and you knew you were getting closer and closer. And then we were dumped unceremoniously at the railway station, and again everybody then trickled out. There was no more running. And so I got out and I wandered, and that's all I did, is I just wandered. And I had the camera with me, and I remember going into, there was a magnificent composition in the main square. The church had been taken out, and a huge building beside it had been taken out, and there was just the skeleton of charred roofs. And the steeple of the church had come straight down into the square in its entirety. And the steeples were metal clad at the top, and it has a sort of onions with another steeple, another pointed bit out of the top. And so I stepped back to take a photograph, and some uniformed guy came out of a building and pointed a rifle at me and said, "Nay." And I said, "I'm English, I don't understand." I was told later, very dangerous, because I could have actually been shot then and there.
Yes, I was wondering what they made of you. You know, how were you going about? What did you look like?
I wore jeans. I had black jeans on. I had normal city shoes, no walking shoes. I had a pinstripe shirt. I had a jersey. And I had a ski jacket.
And this was deliberate, was it, to give a particular
image?
This
was deliberate in the sense that I didn't want to look military. I could have worn military-styled stuff. I didn't want to wear that, because that would have identified me as something to do with police or whatever. I didn't want to look like a journalist either, because they would be targeted too. I did take the attitude, and I think it was a correct attitude, because otherwise I would never have done it, that I'm an Englishman and nobody's going to touch me. And I think if I had thought any other way, I wouldn't have had the confidence to do it, and I would be always afraid. And what helped is that I did not know that area of Europe. As a child, I knew the rest of Europe, but I did not know that area, so I did not know the psychology behind what people did. And as I'd learnt later, the psychology is shoot first, ask questions later.
Did you think of wearing protection at all?
No. No. Like you always see on television is the typical classical detective is never have a gun, because you start using a gun, then you're in danger. Or never carry a knife or this or that, because then you have to use it. So I was threatened. And the idea for me was to pretend I was stupid. Don't understand you. And I saw I wasn't going to get anywhere with that, so I stopped and withdrew. And he went back like a clockwork soldier. He was extraordinary. He just retreated exactly the way he'd come out. Instead of bringing up his gun to his shoulder, he just lowered his gun and walked backwards back into his doorway.
End of reel 2, Nicholas Gibbs.